Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With mounting skepticism about the plausibility and strategic purpose of an alleged Iranian plot to assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador in the United States, we'll begin with an expert on Iran, Flint Leverett, who served as Senior Director for Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council in the Bush administration before resigning over Middle East policy. We will discuss the inner workings of the Iranian regime and assess how they see their foreign policy working, since many analysts now suggest Iran's influence in the region is waning. Then we'll be joined by Jim Hightower, the former Texas Agriculture Commissioner, who lost his job to Karl Rove and Rick Perry and is now a popular populist voice on the radio and in his nationally syndicated columns. We'll discuss the pay-to-play Texas governor and his chances of becoming president, as well as the Occupy Wall Street movement and other subjects. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by the son of a former CIA spymaster whose mysterious life and death is profiled in a new documentary feature, The Man Nobody Knew. Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Carl Colby offers a probing history of the CIA in this personal memoir about his father and the strange and secretive world he grew up in. Joining us now is Flint Leverett, Professor of International Affairs at Penn State University and Senior Fellow at the New American Foundation. From 1992 to 2003, he served as Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as CIA Senior Analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He is the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Tehran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint Leverett.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, there's a great deal of tension, if not confusion, between the United States and Iran at the moment, following the Attorney General Holder's announcement a couple of days ago that of an alleged Iranian terror plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. This has been met with a lot of skepticism. Where do you come down on it, Flint Leverett?
Well, definitely count me on the side of the skeptics. I mean, I'm prepared to accept, I guess, that there are some conversations between Mr. Abbasiar and his cousin in Iran. There appears to be this testimony from a confidential source who himself has serious legal problems with the federal government. But the idea that this was some sort of coordinated planned intelligence operation, run by the highest levels of the Revolutionary Guard and authorized by the highest levels of the Iranian leadership structure, as the Obama administration would like us to believe, I don't think that is plausible at all.
Well, a friend of mine, Bob Baer, former CIA officer, he's pretty emphatic that this is not the Quds force that he knows, that they're very professional, and if they want to kill you, you're dead before you know it.
Well, Bob is, I think, probably as much as any American is qualified to talk about the Quds Force's tradecraft and their approach to the way they do business and how fundamentally this is such a departure from the way that they have normally done business. I look at it more from a standpoint of strategy and policy, that this is just such a departure from the way that the Islamic Republic has conducted itself in the region. It would, the way that they make strategic calculations, it would just be such a, not just nonsensical, but really counterproductive kind of choice for them to make.
Well, clearly, though, the Iranian Revolution started with causes belli by holding American diplomats hostage, and that had if this plot is in fact can be laid at the supreme leader's doorstep or the leadership in Tehran, it amounts to causes belli. But I take it there's a substantial difference, assuming that the supreme leader would be the person to authorize such an action. This supreme leader is not the same as Ayatollah Khamenei, who was quite primitive and had very little understanding of the real world outside of his clerical life. But Harmony, the current leader, is I think a lot more worldly. He still has a tremendous hostility to the United States and to the West. But my understanding is that he's not a sort of primitive, if you will, like his predecessor Ayatollah.
Well, yeah. I think I have a different reading of Ayatollah Khomeini than you do. But leaving that aside, I think you're absolutely right that Ayatollah Khamenei, the current supreme leader who succeeded Khomeini in 1989 when Khomeini died, this is someone who really does have a lot of experience in affairs of state. Before he became the supreme leader, he had served as Iran's president. He had been Khomeini's representative to the defense ministry and to the Revolutionary Guard in the early stages of the Iran-Iraq war. You know, he has a lot of experience in international affairs, a lot of experience in matters of state. And I think that experience really shapes the way he thinks about Iranian foreign policy and Iran's place in the region. And I think it is really utterly uncharacteristic of him, I think, to make the kind of calculation that would lead him to approve something like this. It flies in the face of our now 20 years of experience with him as the supreme leader, more than 20 years, and you know a fair amount of experience with him in high level positions before that.
But Flint Leverett, given the initial hostage taking and subsequent assassinations on foreign soil, this is not a regime that plays by the normal rules. Perhaps he's more of a realist than his predecessor, but they have, shall we say, broken the rules.
Well, I think that their response to that would be that you know other people don't play by the normal rules where they're concerned. You know, the United States, you know, ran a covert operation that overthrew a democratically elected government in 1953, reinstalled the Shah. After the Shah was deposed, they believe they have evidence that the United States was in contact with oppositionists and was looking for ways that they could bring down the Islamic Republic. The United States knew in advance about the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, did nothing to stop it, and then actually provided various types of support and even intelligence to Saddam Hussein to help him prosecute that war of aggression against Iran. So, you know, to some degree, Iranians, I think, would say, you know, let's not be too fastidious in this concept about normal rules because, you know, the United States and other great powers haven't observed those rules in dealing with us.
Well, I think in the current situation, surely Flint Leverett, there is a lot of covert pressure being exercised. Not the least of which is the string of assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists. And my understanding is that Iran lost its second biggest customer for oil, India, because of banking sanctions, and the Saudis stepped in immediately to fill that demand. So they must be feeling a little paranoid.
Well, I think they always feel themselves, you know, they know that the United States is out to isolate them, depress them economically in every way possible, and they believe, not without reason, that the United States would actually, if it had an opportunity to get rid of the Islamic Republic, would act to do so. And, you know, you can call that paranoia, but, you know, as Henry Kissinger famously said, sometimes even paranoids actually have enemies. And I think the Islamic Republic has a basically pretty reasonable, you know, reality-based assessment of the threats that they face. And they are not a country that has a lot of conventional military power. I mean, ideas that the Islamic Republic is going to conquer anybody, invade anybody, is just ludicrous. They really can't project conventional military force beyond their borders. And so they have developed over the years a national security strategy that emphasizes, I think, you know, three big things. One is they cultivate relationships with proxy allies in important regional states. You know, these are political and social movements, and oftentimes they also have paramilitary capabilities like Hezbollah in Lebanon. They do develop asymmetric military capabilities, ballistic missiles, this kind of thing. And then I think one of the most important and underappreciated parts of their strategy in the United States and in the West is what you might call sort of soft power offensive. They think they can actually do a better job of winning hearts and minds across the region than the United States can. And over time, as they work on this, they think this actually, first of all, constrains regional regimes that might be prepared to work with the United States against them. It constrains their ability to do that. But over time, they think it actually ends up, you know, undermining regimes that have it in for the Islamic Republic and, you know, produces governments that are going to be less interested in cooperation with the United States, more receptive to their message. They look at the Arab Spring, they think they're winning out of this. You know, to have Egypt become a country with an even somewhat more independent foreign policy, that's a huge gain for them. And they think the region is, over time, it is breaking their way. And in that context, for them to be involved in trying to conduct, you know, assassinations against Saudi officials, it would actually work against that, which is in the end one of their most potent strategic assets.
Again, I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, Professor of International Affairs at Penn State University and Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. From 1992 to 2003, he served as a Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's Policy Planning Staff, and as a CIA Senior Analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran. So Flint Leverett, on the other side, some analysts would argue, well, Iran may have had some success in the region, and certainly there is a sort of rivalry in the Muslim world between them and the Saudis for legitimacy and hegemony, I guess. But they've lost Hamas. The Egyptian Brotherhood has replaced the Syrians as the sponsors, if you will, of Hamas. The Syrian regime is teetering. Iran's pumping money in there. They may lose that, and that if they lose Syria or their influence in Syria, then that would isolate Hezbollah. So give me a sense of what the regime thinks about those developments.
I think I understand there are people who say that. I think that's a misreading of the region. More importantly, it's not the way Iran reads the region. They actually think that, you know, Bashar al-Assad is going to make it in Syria, that he's not going to get overthrown, that he is going to make it, and he is going to continue to be an important ally for Iran in the region. Even if that assessment is incorrect and President Assad were not to make it, I think it's a mistake to believe that Iran is without options in that situation. I think any successor regime to the Assad government in Syria, it's not going to be better disposed toward cooperation with Israel, cooperation with the United States, than the current political order in Syria. I think Iran would find a way to work with the successor regime. But, you know, the bottom line, I think, for the decision makers in Tehran is they don't think Bashar al-Assad is going to go. I think they would not see it that the Egyptian Brotherhood has replaced Syria as the great patron or the, you know, conduit for Hamas. You know, Khaled Mashal still, you know, based in Damascus. Iran is still a very, very important partner for Hamas. And while I think Hamas is delighted by the turn of events in Egypt, just like Iran is, I don't think that puts, you know, it's not a zero-sum situation. that the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is going to play a more of a role in Egyptian politics, and is now able to have a closer relationship with Hamas. That's not a zero sum kind of loss for Iran. From an Iranian perspective, to have Egypt taking a very, very different position toward Hamas, they actually think that is in the bigger picture, that is very much in their strategic interests. And so a lot of the things that people adduce here as things that would make the Iranians feel under pressure and maybe even prompt them to do something that, you know, basically doesn't make any sense, you know, I think it really ignores how Iranians themselves actually see the region and think that the region is evolving. I mean, you could say that assessment is wrong, but I do think very strongly that it is the Iranian assessment.
And what about the other fairly pervasive assessment, Flint Leverett, that Turkey is the rising power in that region, eclipsing Iran?
Yeah, I mean, there too, I think it tries to paint a situation as a zero-sum kind of game where Iran doesn't really see it that way. I mean, just think about this. You know, look back longer than the last 6 months or the last 12 months or the last 2 years and look at where Turkey was even just 10 years ago. This, you know, very, very, you know, solidly pro-Western, pro-Israeli, very secular kind of country in the Middle East. I mean, while Turkey's still a NATO member, and I wouldn't say in any way Turkey had become anti-Western. I mean, over the last 10 years, Turkey has completely reoriented its foreign policy toward the region, and that has played overwhelmingly to Iran's benefit. I mean, yes, in the current situation, there are some disagreements between Iran and Turkey over Syria, for example. There are some, more tactical-level disagreements between Iran and Turkey over how to deal with certain Turkish terrorist groups that plague both Iran and Turkey. And there appear to be some tactical disagreements between the two right now over how to deal with these groups. But if you look at the bigger strategic picture, that you have Turkey now, you know, basically taking, you know, a much, much, much tougher line toward Israel, a Turkey that is much, much more willing to take major foreign policy decisions independent of its relationship with the United States. That is an overwhelming plus for the Islamic Republic. And even if there are some, you know, there are some differences over Syria, some differences over other issues, you know, the idea that that Turkey is now a problem for Iran, you know, I think that if you really look at that in historical perspective, you know, you wouldn't characterize it that way.
Well, just in closing, Flint Leverett, obviously the skepticism about this alleged plot on the part of an Iranian American used car salesman from Texas, in league with a cartel, a Mexican drug cartel assassin who is actually either an imposter or somebody compromised by the Drug Enforcement Administration. Then you add to that the recent history of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Your wife, Hillary Mann Leverett, was on CNN recently pointing this out, that, you know, that there's been manufactured evidence, if you will. One of the things that I recall was, of course, the Nijed forgeries, which became a part of the causes belli, if you will, in terms of Iraq. Yeah. I remember actually interviewing a senior CIF official at the time about that, and he said that they were manufactured here in the United States, not in Italy. And I said, well, would Michael Ledeen have anything to do with it? And immediately Michael Ledeen threatened to sue me. And I've always been astounded at why the U.S. press, so much ink was spilled about the Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson, but so little investigative journalism went into the origin of these documents. Who forged them? Because one thing is pretty clear, that Dick Cheney kept trying to sell these documents time and time again.
You raise a really, really profoundly important issue. I think it's absolutely true that in the run-up to the Iraq War, you know, all of the institutions that in American society we rely on to act as a kind of critical check, to exercise some critical scrutiny over what the executive branch wants to do, whether it's Congress, whether it's think tanks, whether it's the media, as you said, all of these institutions basically failed to do their jobs. And for the media especially, you know, after there were, you know, there was some effort after the fact at big journalistic outlets to kind of do postmortems and see where they went wrong and say, okay, we can learn our lessons here. But if you look at the way a lot of the coverage on Iran is going now, you know, it's really not clear that the lessons from the run-up to the Iraq War have really been learned. You know, I don't really understand why, but it seems as if the advent of the 24/7 news cycle, the, you know, vast proliferation of news outlets, has actually rendered, let's call them the bigger, more mainstream media outlets, less willing to challenge authority than challenge what the executive branch is saying, you know, challenge it just in a basic, okay, let's see if this adds up, let's see if what you're saying is really substantiated. You know, they seem less willing to do that than it sometimes in the past. And, you know, why that is a really, really profoundly important question. And I wish I really knew the answer to it, and I'm not, you know, not confident that I do. But I think it is a profoundly important question, and it is really incumbent on all of us as citizens, as consumers of news, and so forth. It is really incumbent on us to kind of insist on media reporting, journalism on these issues, where people really do ask the hard questions, ask the necessary follow-up, you know, really probe the documentation, really probe the underlying evidence for various types of claims. That wasn't done in the run-up to the Iraq War, and we basically had administration that lied the United States into an unnecessary and, I think, really counterproductive war for American interests as a result. We shouldn't let that happen again.
I thank you for joining us, Flint Leverett.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Pennsylvania State University and a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. From 1992 to 2003, he served as a senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He is the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with Jim Hightower, who lost his job to Karl Rove and Rick Perry. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Hightower, a best-selling author, radio commentator, nationally syndicated columnist, and editor of the Hightower Lowdown, a populist political newsletter. He has spent the past four decades battling the powers that be on behalf of the powers that ought to be, consumers, working families, small businesses, environmentalists, and just plain folks. Twice elected Texas Agricultural Commissioner, Jim is an all-round populist agitator who believes that the true political spectrum is not right to left, but top to bottom. So welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Hightower.
Hey, Ian. It's great to be back with the background.
And it's good to talk to a 99%er.
Yes, indeed. Isn't this terrific? I'm just wildly enthused about the Occupy Together movement all across the country. We've got a good one going here in Austin, but also in Dallas and down in McAllen, Texas. Surprising places.
Well, in contrast to that optimism that's being manifested on the streets across the country, if you watched last Tuesday's Republican presidential debate, you might as well be back in the 16th century. In fact, Governor Perry said the founding fathers were in America in the 16th century. So he's the guy.
I think those were the great great grandfathers.
So you know, tell me,
Perry really puts the goober in gubernatorial. I can tell you.
Of course, he beat you, didn't he? I mean, am I going to hold you responsible for Rick Perry?
I guess you could. Actually, it's Karl Rove beat me. Karl Rove, Perry was a Democratic House member in the legislature, and in 1990, Phil Graham and Bill Clements, then the Republican governor, wanted me out, as did the chemical lobbyists here in the state, because I promulgated some pesticide regulations that they did not like. Perry carried that legislation for them, and then Karl Rove, we were able to defeat them on their bills. But then Karl Rove went to Perry, got him to switch parties to run against me, and then Rove went out and raised about $3 million to throw it at the television sets with the kind of patented nasty negative lying ads that he later became famous for. And Perry was such an inept campaigner that Rove sent him out to West Texas just going to county farm bureau meetings to get him out of the way, because Perry knew nothing about Dallas or Houston or South Texas. So it ended up that Perry was sort of a no-show in his own campaign. It was really Rove who did it.
But Perry's clearly, could you call him a political opportunist since he switched parties?
As
he also didn't he basically lay the foundation of this pay to play politics that he's quite a practitioner of.
Exactly right. The experience with the chemical lobbyists, him carrying their bill, that taught him who would butter his biscuits, and they've been buttering his biscuits ever since. Not just the chemical lobbyists, but big business generally, big drug companies, the giant waste disposal outfits, and others have put the money in his pocket, and he in turn does governmental favors for them.
So, Jim, So, Jim Hightower, the candidate that you mentioned, Rick Perry, that was Karl Rove put up to run against you, and essentially it was Karl Rove's campaign. He really won, not Perry. Perry was a poor politician on the stump. How would you rate him today? Because my understanding, even though he's floundered, he came in top of the polls for the Republicans, and then he's gone down. And clearly, the Republican establishment want Mitt Romney, but the base probably will support Perry because particularly the Christian fundamentalists simply will not vote for a Mormon. That's my understanding. So, how would you rate his chances, notwithstanding that he's proven to be a bit of a dud?
Well, not very good. He is now a very good campaigner. He's good on the stump, and he is good in kind of going into cafes and shaking hands and making people perk up. He is not, however, as we have seen, good when he has to be on his own in a debate anytime he gets any sort of serious questioning. You know, Ted Williams, the great baseball player, once used to advise rookies, if you don't think too good, don't think too much. Well, that's Perry's problem, as he does not think too good, and that's now showing up on the campaign trail. So one other factor is this: there's so many uglies in his background that while the base likes his or the hardcore far right wing Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann type Republicans like his extremist stuff on he's a tenther, he's a birther, you know, he doesn't want government involved in anybody's life except his own, because he's done very well on the government payroll over the years. But there's so many ugly things beneath him, though, in terms of his pay-to-play style of governing, his corporate cronyism that you mentioned earlier, and then his corruption, because he's got a lot of, you know, he became a multimillionaire while being in Texas politics, and that's not because he was making millions of dollars in salary. It's because he got favors done for him as well.
So, Jim Hightower, just to finish up on this, because I want to talk to you, obviously, about the event that you'll be at here in Los Angeles for this coming Saturday, October the 15th. Does this mean, though, that given the extent to which Mormonism is an anathema to Christian fundamentalists and that the religious right seems to have taken over, if not the Republican Party, certainly the Republican primary process, and Perry's first event that before he announced on the eve of his announcement was to hold a kind of religious rally down in Houston, and I think the message he put out there was, I'm not a Mormon. So in spite of what we're saying about him, is there still a chance that because of the Republican primary process and its domination by the Christian right, that he still could become the nominee?
Well, there's always a chance. You know, we've seen weird things happen in recent years. So, there's a chance. But it's not looking real good for him, because it's not just the establishment is opposed to him, but he's running fourth in polls in Iowa of Republican caucus participants, likely participants. He's running fourth in New Hampshire. He finished in the big straw poll down in Florida, not only behind Herman Cain, but down there with Rick Santorum. So he's got some, and at this values conference that was held a couple of weeks ago, he was expecting to win that one, and instead he ran about fourth or fifth in it as well. So I think he's got a heap of hurt. You know, Ian, they say that the higher the monkey climbs, the more you see of its ugly side. And I think that's what's happening to Rick Perry.
Well, I guess all those big oil men that are funding him are going to be disappointed. Jim Hightower, let's turn to the event on Saturday that you're coming out here to Los Angeles for. You are speaking along with John Nichols. It's an event Progressive Democrats of America are putting on. What are you going to be talking about? I guess the theme of PDA is healthcare, not warfare.
Well, it is one of their themes, but they are the overt, proud, unabashed pushers of a solid progressive agenda within the Democratic Party. Obviously, we're not getting that out of the White House or out of the Congress, but we won't get it until we build a grassroots network of solid progressives, electing a good number of them to Congress and to state legislative seats and governorships and et cetera. And that's the real mission of progressive Democrats, is to see that we really put progressives in office, and thereby we put a little bit of progress in progressive.
So the movement that's afoot across the land, which is spontaneous and totally unconnected to the Democratic Party, it is a kind of authentic version, if you will, of the Tea Party, which pretended to have populist roots and may well have had some populist roots, but was essentially co-opted by the Kochs and orchestrated and organized by your nemesis, Karl Rove, and Dick Armey. So I've spoken to a lot of people in Zuccotti Park and down here in Los Angeles at Occupy LA and City Hall, and they don't feel that they belong to any political party. So is there any kind of way to find a marriage in the future? Because the Republicans very cleverly use the Tea Party to elect, yes, what, 60 so congressmen and completely capture the legislative agenda in the Congress. Is there any way that this energy can be tapped and that progressives can get representation in Congress?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know whether that'll be through the Democratic Party or not. That's up to them to decide. Nobody is going to be able, from my perception of who these folks are, nobody's going to be able to co-opt them, direct them, guide them. They're going to be making up their own minds, and they're doing it in a very little-d democratic way. I'm very impressed with the organization, contrary to what you're hearing in the establishment media. These people are actually very tightly organized and very tightly focused, as you indicate. Theirs is a true populism. The Tea Party came into existence because of the Wall Street bailout. And then Dick Armey and the Koch brothers, with some of their front groups, came in and diverted them off to be supporters of the corporate agenda. How ironic is that? Including deregulating Wall Street. So off they went into the anti-populism. But these folks are squarely focused on financial and corporate power in America and the use of that power to purchase our government wholesale and cause that government to turn its back on the middle class as well as the poor in our country. So it is a genuine progressive movement by instinct and by issues and belief. Now, where it goes, I don't know. But yeah, at some point they will be a political force. How big? Nobody knows. But you know, at the very least, they bring us fresh hope and new ideas to, you know, put a little move in the movement. And that alone is worth our support and encouragement. So I'm definitely behind it. And, you know, wherever it ends up politically, you know, we'll have to see where they want to go.
So, Jim Hightower, do you think that there's a lesson to be learned here? If the far right of the Republican Party can be repackaged as the Tea Party and capture the party and capture the national political agenda, not to mention the attention of the press, Fox News, of course, being an arm of the Tea Party, up to the propaganda arm, if you will. Why not progressives capturing the Democratic Party? Obviously, Clinton and company sold it out to Wall Street, and the DLC types are in control of the party, but they're completely bankrupt. They don't have a message. The public is moving way ahead of them. I don't understand, you know, because the fatal thing about third parties, if you can see what happened with Ralph Nader and others, is that they just split the vote and you end up with the George Bushes or the Ronald Reagans or the Richard Nixons. And that's the historical record, clear as you can get. So I've never understood that, why there can't be an insurrection on the left as there was on the right.
Well, I think that's what you're seeing. There is. And there are a number of us, of course, who've been out there over the years hammering this, and Progressive Democrats of America, and coming to L.A. this Saturday for an event. That's exactly what they're all about. Now we have new energy that's being developed. Now, it's not just those folks who are in the street, but the fact that overwhelming majorities of the American people agree with them on most of their fundamental issues, and certainly on their general thrust, which is that too few people control too much of the money and power, and they're using that control to get more for themselves at our expense. So that is a very strong populist and very popular populist message. Now, what that can generate is increased turnout. That's where we've been losing. We're not losing because people have turned conservative or Republican. Here in Texas, for example, Rick Perry runs around talking about how he's the very, very popular here in Texas, had a sweeping reelection victory last year, 58% of the vote. What he doesn't tell you is we had the lowest voter turnout in the country. We had 33% of the people vote. That means he's the choice of about 18% of the people. The sad thing is the Democrats couldn't get 19% because they quit being Democrats. They quit talking in language that workaday people can appreciate and hear themselves in. And until we do that, until we get back to those populist roots, until we begin to respond to these kids who are expressing a genuine populism and shouting at the Democratic Party, hey, here we are, you know, if you really want to start winning elections, this is the way to go. We'll see. But, you know, I know that there are plenty of good folks in the Congress who are paying a whole lot of attention to what's being said there, and you might notice that even Barack Obama is now running around making some noise, you know, seems to be listening to his inner FDR just a little bit, at least. So, you know, I don't discount the fact that that these people are going to have a big impact on our politics. It might not happen immediately, but I think in the long term, these folks are going to, with their message, with their enthusiasm, with their energy, with their idealism, these folks are going to move our movement forward.
Well, Jim Hightower, I just spoke yesterday with Jesse LaGreca, who's just came out of this movement. He's been there from the beginning in Zuccotti Park, and he was on the Sunday talk show. First of all, he did a takedown of a Fox producer who was in there to try and dismiss them and do a kind of hit job on him. That went viral, but you know, ABC put him on there. Sunday Gab Fest, and he made this powerful point. He said, "I'm probably the first working class guy you've ever had on this show." And I got, when I was just talking to him yesterday, and I got this feeling that you know how McCain used the phony working man Joe the plumber, and the Republicans only get elected if they get Democratic votes. That's just the way that it works in this country. There are not enough millionaires and billionaires, and they rely upon the so-called Reagan Democrats to get them over the top. So you have a party that's highly organized. They've disenfranchised 5 million potential Democratic voters in 2012 already. So they play pretty hard ball. But the other party, which has a hard time getting its message out, and more importantly, has a hard time inspiring people to vote, it's got the natural numbers, but it doesn't inspire them. Now, Obama did in 2008. My feeling is that it's people like Jesse LaGreca that are going to inspire people in 2012.
That's how I get inspired, by doing a lot of traveling. I've been just about every place that's got a zip code, and this is not just this year. Everywhere I go, I find people who are on the move, who are doing things, very progressive things, who are fighting and winning, who are building different kinds of businesses, creating new kinds of political forums and avenues, who are working through health care to make that available to just regular people. Again and again, tremendously inspiring folks at the local level, and that is what I totally agree with you. That is what is going to inspire other people, and I think folks are inspired right now by what's happening on Wall Street and then on the Occupy Together cities, more than 200 of them around the country. This is something big.
Jim Hightower, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always glad to be with you, Ian.
So I was just speaking then with Jim Hightower, who's a best-selling author, radio commentator, nationally syndicated columnist and editor of the Hightower Lowdown, a populist political newsletter. He has spent the past four decades battling the powers that be on behalf of the powers that ought to be, consumers, working families, small businesses, environmentalists, and just plain folks. Twice elected Texas Agriculture Commissioner, Jim is an all-round populist agitator who believes that the true political spectrum is not right to left, but top to bottom. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the son of America's top spymaster, who has made a film about his mysterious father. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Carl Colby, who's a director and producer and an award-winning documentary filmmaker who has made films about such subjects as Franz Kline, William de Clooney, Bob Marley, Frank Gehry, George Harrell, and Franco Zeffirelli. And his latest film, which is about his father, The Man Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Colby, which opens tomorrow, October the 14th, at the New Art in West L.A. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Colby.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
And this is, I guess, a subject you know well, your father, but on the other hand, you didn't really know him.
Well, exactly. Like, that's why it's called The Man Nobody Knew. A bit facetious, but at the same time, in making other films, particularly with people like Franz Kline, I remember interviewing, you know, dozens of people. And at the end of the day, I thought, my God, they all know a different Franz Kline. And I interviewed over 85 people on this film and really, you know, spread a wide net. And I kind of came away with a different Bill Colby sort of from each angle. And it was a very strange process. I almost just didn't do it at all. And you might think, you know, I've been making documentaries. Why wouldn't I have turned the cameras on my father much earlier on, and especially before he died? But whenever I'd sort of think about that and broach the subject and sort of approach him about that, and particularly when I would ask him sort of tough questions, personal questions, you know, why did you divorce my mother? Or why do you care about CIA? Or why? He might answer that, but he wouldn't answer, tell me the motivation. And he would say, well, that's your department, friend. He had very good at compartmentalization. It's as if he could be looking at you with a straight face and talk about the weather, and someone could be sawing off his right arm. Someone could be sawing off his right arm and he wouldn't flinch. It was very bizarre.
So the film opens, of course, with news clips of the mysterious death of your father. And he was missing for a number of days, canoeing on Chesapeake. And it sort of starts the process of mystery. So give us a sense of your childhood, Carl Colby, growing up with a father who ended up running the CIA. Was it always mysterious? Did you ever know where your dad went to work? And did he ever? How was your day at the office today, Dad?
Right. Actually, it was very strange. I only spent 2 weeks in the United States when I was born, and then shipped off to Sweden, and then from there to Italy. We lived in Rome and down near the Colosseum, and then up in the Via Cassia across the way from the daughter of De Gasperi, the prime minister. We always seemed to be living very close by very high dignitaries, and once wondered whether that wasn't just purposeful. And so at first I simply thought he worked for the embassy. You know, he worked as...
Well, he was undercover probably at the embassy.
Absolutely. His cover was diplomatic cover, which my mother in the film says is sort of a perfect cover, because it's not as strenuous as having to pretend you're a businessman or be in some sort of very surreptitious work. And
right, and if anything goes wrong, you've got to get out of jail pass because you've got diplomatic immunity.
Right, and you get thrown out of the country. You won't get shot. And and so at the beginning, it was all sort of, I thought he worked for the embassy. And then I was on the diving board of the Cirque Sportif in Saigon in 1961, and a friend of mine turned to me and said, you know, your dad's a spy. And I said, no, he works for the embassy. He said, no, he's CIA. He's an agent. He's a spy. And I thought, God. And I went back and asked my father. I said, well, I heard you work for the CIA. And he turned to me and sort of gave me one of those wan smiles and just said, well, let's keep that our little secret.
Again, we're talking about the film, The Man Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Colby, by his son, Carl Colby, who's joining me in the studio. So, Carl, you know, most of our audience, first of all, a lot of people around this building think I work for the CIA simply because I talk to ex-government people, because I figure they're the ones with the secrets.
Right.
I'm a journalist. I want to find out what's going on.
Right.
You know, it's logical to my mind, but who knows? But the long and the short of it is, as you well know, a lot of people think the CIA is worse than the devil. Now, tell me about the bad stuff. And was there any time in your relationship with your father the Phoenix program, of course,
right,
and other things that he was involved in, ever came up, or with your mother? Or give us a sense of that.
Yeah, the film really delves into that. And obviously, if I hadn't gone into that, I would have just been whitewashing it. What's the point? I think ultimately it's a morality tale. And that's how it played out in our family. It was as if there was a struggle for the moral high ground in our family. My mother was a devout Catholic, and so was my father. But it had to be moral. It had to be good. It had to be right, what you're doing. And your audience might think, well, that sounds very naive. It's CIA. But my mother understood there will be war. There can be war. There have been wars, and there will be. And deception has its place. But it had to be moral. So when she saw him engaged in things like the aftermath of the Diem coup, where he was murdered, I mean, President Diem and Nodin knew and Madame knew. We used to go to their house. We socialized with them. I knew their children. I mean, this was devastating to see this happen. My father was against the coup, but he went along with it. And so you start chipping away at what you're taking on as in faith and in trust, that what he's doing is the right thing. So particularly, in a sense, one of the tricks of the film is I grow up through the course of the film. At first, I'm a young, adoring 7-9-year-old boy who loves his dad, you know, the ex-OSS paratrooper. But then when I see him engaged with generals and police in Vietnam and bodies start coming back in bags and you see victims of really horrendous acts of violence and napalm being just destroying a countryside that I had known and places that I'd been to, you ask questions. And his questions all seem very logical. You know, I'm trying to help the villagers and we're trying to root out the infrastructure of the VC. But as it happens in the film, and it's shown by all sorts of footage, I look to the side and I see on television, you know, napalm destroying villages and people running around naked and their flesh burning. And you wonder, to what end? I mean, whose God are we fighting under? And so the film really becomes a struggle for the truth with my mother, myself, and my father.
Your parents divorced, and how old were you when that happened? That was pretty late in life, because I remember that was
what... Well, you're giving away the punchline in the film.
Okay, well, let's not do that.
That's okay. I mean, I know. What's interesting is that all this tension builds up.
Right.
Because here's this wonderful sort of war hero, and my mother is Barbara Stanwyck with an Ivy League education, a New York chick, you know, from Greenwich Village, literally, went to Barnard. I mean, the kind of girl you'd go out with and have a lot of fun with, you know. And it all is terrific. And as you say, in the 50s, it's all lovely and romantic. And who are we tonight? She would literally say, well, what cover are we tonight? Who are we pretending to be? And it all sounds very romantic. And then my father and I and our family would go off to the north and on a little picnic. And we would drop a radio to somebody in the woods. And, well, what's that about? Or priests would come to the house. And why are there so many priests here? And why are there cardinals and bishops? And this is not religious. This is political. He's winning an election. He's passing money through the Vatican. So I think what became of all this was that it's all well and good at that stage. But I think by the 60s, after the Bay of Pigs and after the Vietnam War gets going in earnest, you know, we all started raising a lot of questions.
Well, we won't give it away, Colby, but the film, you know, we talked about the dark side, but your father did show great courage in the church committee hearings and he told me about how frustrating it was with James Jesus Angledon running counterintelligence, who might as well have been working for the Soviets. I mean, he totally relied on the Israelis who were playing the Americans. They had the only assets inside the Soviet Union, at least that after we'd lost everybody. And he alone, Angledon was the one who fueled the Cold War paranoia by exaggerating the Russian bear. And we all know that the Russian bear was a myth. It was all a Potemkin village, you know, a third world country with nuclear weapons, and that one day it collapsed. And it probably could have collapsed a lot earlier.
Right.
And your father finally just had to get rid of this guy because he was destroying the agency from within.
And it was strange, as you know, I mean, because you know this history so well, that Angledon himself, a great Anglophile, had been completely snookered by
Philby
back in 63 and 64. I mean, here he'd been passing the top secret information on all of our operations to the number two, really, at the time, Philby, who was working for the Soviets all the time.
Right.
I mean, imagine what... I'm surprised that Angledon just didn't collapse out of just, sheer nervous breakdown, that he even continued in the job. I mean, to have your closest associate turn on you like that must be something. See, my father was not...
But he had a hard time firing him. I mean, he had...
Yeah.
And he took on... quite a lobby, that kind of right wing lobby in Washington itself. You know,
I mean, my father ran afoul because when those Church and Pike hearings started going, let's face it, the American public had not been, the Congress certainly, and the Democratic Congress had not been let in on any decisions of any merit, you know, leading on to the war in Vietnam. So now all of a sudden the war's over, we lost, and all this is coming out about the CIA. Well, God, what have we been doing since the Eisenhower mind control experiments on unwitting human guinea pigs, LSD experiments, assassinations, many assassination attempts? And so my father took it all in, and I think really one of the discoveries I made in the film is I really think he was angered by being fired, but he was kind of the sacrificial lamb, the phoenix himself.
Right.
I think he took it all in and said, you know, we're going to burn, but let me burn as long as the ship stays afloat, which I think is what happened.
Right. But, you know, of course, didn't George W. Bush fire him?
No, Ford fired him, but I think something you've...
I mean, not George W., I should say H.W.,
No, H.W. Bush
succeeded him.
Bush 41 replaced him, Ford. And as Woodward says so memorably in the film, he asked Ford, he said, well, why George Bush Sr. to be DCI, head of CIA, after your father? He said, I wanted a loyalist. And he said, who do you consider loyal? And it's the great line. He says, Kissinger, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Greenspan.
And there is the American tragedy.
Well, I mean, it's what's interesting about this is some of your listeners may think, oh, this is all well and good, kind of a history lesson, but what does it have to do with today? Well, what it has to do with today is, as you well know, the American public has written the CIA basically a blank check now. And this president, of all presidents, is cashing it. He's conducting more covert, clandestine, paramilitary operations since the days of JFK.
And he's just killed a couple of American citizens and everybody's cheering.
Well, the crazy part about this is, I mean, maybe she's not the only one to talk, but at least Jane Harman and a few others have said, what are the rules of engagement? What is the policy? Or what are we afraid of? An extraordinary person, and actually who's a family friend, is the great Patrick Leahy, senator from Vermont, head of judiciary. When I interviewed him, I said, well, why is everybody so scared of these secrets? And he said, yeah, what are we afraid of?
Right.
And if what you're afraid of is the truth, or if what you're afraid of is that we as collective Americans will decide that, you know, we're not going to engage in certain things, then so be it. But don't hide it from us. And right now it's like it's all being hidden and the Congress is just not willing to even talk about these things.
Well, Carl Coby, we've run out of time here, but I thank you for joining us in the studio. And again, Carl Coby, award-winning documentary filmmaker, his new film, The Man Nobody Knew, In Search of My Father, CIA Spymaster William Comey. It opens tomorrow at the New Art in West Los Angeles. And again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at ianmasters.com. You can also sign up for podcasts and contact me there. And I'll be back again on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.